Hello, this is Martha Baskin. The following interview was conducted in mid-October 2001 with Eric Margolis, veteran war correspondent and foreign editor for the Toronto Sun newspapers. He is author most recently of War at the Top of the World, The Struggle for Afghanistan, Kashmir, and Tibet.
See if we can talk about what is not being said in this new mantra, the war on terrorism, the inherent hypocrisy in the U.S. quest.
Well, that's a loaded question. The United States, the mistake Washington is making, and it's made all along, it's nothing new, is that it is trying to portray terrorism as an organic, anonymous element that has no relation to any of the policies of the United States, that it's an evil force like a whirlwind or a pestilence, and it is doing what the U.S. has done over decades, and that is trying to personalize anti-U.S. behavior or sentiment in a few people to make the whole war against terrorism much simpler and more comprehensible to the American people.
So what key facts then are being withheld from the public?
It's not so much withheld. It's simply that the American public does not understand how involved the United States is in so many countries, particularly in the Muslim world, and that the United States has been making and unmaking governments, assassinating leaders, bombing countries, imposing and keeping in power repressive regimes. And it's been doing this for, you know, at least 30 years, if not 40 years, and that eventually in the course of ruling what I call America's oil Raj, after the British Indian Raj, eventually the natives are biting back. It's what the British called the cost of empire.
Well, then let's actually jump to that question, which is rarely mentioned, the struggle for domination in Central Asia, which has been termed, I think, the new great game, this control of the region's energy reserves.
That's right. Energy plays a major role in Washington strategic thinking, and even events in Afghanistan have an energy facet to them, because Afghanistan is a logical route for energy exports, for pipelines running south from Central Asia. So it's very important to the U.S. to have a compliant government in Afghanistan, and to have a tranquil Afghanistan so that it can be used as a conduit for energy exports from Central Asia.
And those were the Soviets' hopes when they were engaged in there.
Not so much. The Soviets weren't thinking primarily of energy exports so much as they were of strategic geopolitics. In my view, the Soviets eventually wanted to push south from Afghanistan into Pakistan and to reach the Arabian Sea as a long-term Russian strategic goal. It's the old famous warm water port goal of the Russians. And in fact, I don't think they've given it up, and that they're going to be back again one of these days. It's Russia's push to the seas. It's an ancient historic theme in Russian history. But energy is certainly dominating the United States view in the area, and there's been a confrontation or struggle going on between the United States and Iran and Turkey, with the Israelis thrown in, and Pakistan, over the routes of the oil pipelines for taking out both Central Asia and Caspian oil.
And there have then also been major gas companies engaged already in the region that have.
Oh, yes.
What can you share more on that subject?
Well, the United States, major oil and gas people are all many of them are in Central Asia, and Chevron, I believe, has taken a lead in that area, and they're exploring. But that's their job. That's what they're supposed to do, to provide energy for the United States, and they're out there exploring. There's nothing nefarious about that. And it's a particularly time of looming oil shortages, but it certainly influences Washington's policy in the region.
And it certainly isn't front page news either.
No, it isn't. But that's not the oil. You know, energy is not what's currently driving the American attack against Afghanistan. Though I think it is in the minds of the war planners.
Okay, so what would you say then is driving the attack primarily?
First of all, revenge. Americans are thirsting for revenge. I mean, America was not only suffered a, you know, this horrible criminal attack, but it was affronted. A great power was humiliated. It was supposed to be invulnerable. Was attacked by parties unknown. And really made to look weak in front of the world. So as a great power, the United States has to exact revenge for this attack. And what it is, that's why it's now pounding Afghanistan. It's making the rubble bounce.
It's making the rubble bounce. And indeed, there is pounding it, pounding this poor, poor country, already disfigured by landmines and devastated by so much war. What do you think, where do you think this is going to lead?
I think this is, first of all, it's a tragedy. I don't think America should be doing it. And secondly, I think that from what we can discern of Washington's plans now, that it will impose a U.S.-backed, U.S. and Russian-backed government in Kabul, that it's going to lead towards civil war and renewed civil war in Afghanistan indefinitely.
And yet, what should have been the U.S. response?
The U.S. should, first of all, have made public the evidence that it claims links bin Laden to these attacks. It was a major mistake not doing so. I think one of the reasons it wasn't done was that some of this evidence is from wiretaps from other friendly countries' governments and intelligence services. Whatever the case, the world, the non-American world, would have been happier, more comfortable. If the U.S. had demonstrated a solid case, then there would have been almost no opposition to an attempt to get bin Laden. Bin Laden still insists he's innocent, though there's a lot of circumstantial evidence that suggests that he's guilty. And the United States certainly, I think, has a right to go and try and grab him by a commando attack if it can find him, and bring him to justice, though I think the justice should be in the Hague Court, not in the New York Federal Court.
And that's just what I was going to ask you. What legitimate role could the international community play
well,
here?
Well, what's sauce for the Serbian gander ought to be sauce for the Afghani goose. If Milosevic was hauled off to the Hague, why not bin Laden? And then left Afghanistan, and the U.S. could have operated with close to impunity in a search for bin Laden with all its power that it has and now bases nearby. It didn't need to try and overthrow Taliban or pound the country into ruins or terrorize the government into submission. But it's doing it. Americans feel good about it.
And yet, intelligence has been so weak. Supposedly, the CIA has few, Arabic-speaking speakers, let alone, is it Darcy?
Farsi. Well, actually, it's Dari.
Dari,
which is a dialect of Farsi.
Okay.
Yes, and I can say from my own experience that the CIA's human assets, as it's known, are pathetic. And the U.S. has been always retarded by the fact that it must rely on foreign intelligence services for a lot of its information, which is always self-serving.
HUMET, tell the listeners what that stands for.
Human intelligence, HUMINT, as opposed to ELINT, which is electronic intelligence.
Yes.
We can see mouses running around on the ground in Afghanistan, but we don't know where bin Laden is because we don't have men in his organization. Not for lack of trying, I might add, but they just haven't succeeded.
And you'd think that's somewhat odd, considering how many of our great we felt are the evil men exist in the Middle East, that we would at least have knowledgeable knowledgeable people.
Well, in 1998, Bin Laden published a fatwa, a religious decree, by the way, which he has no right to do because he has no religious standing or credentials. But anyway, it said, and if it's a genuine document, it says, you know, kill all Americans and wherever they are. And, you know, why didn't the American Security Services, with their $30 billion a year budget, you know, be more active and, you know, take notice of this? But, you know, there's one incident that's going on now which just fills me with the greatest unease and dismay, and that is that the Air Force is dropping hundreds of thousands of leaflets on Afghanistan as part of the psy war effort, or psychological warfare effort, to make the population abandon its loyalty to the Taliban. And on these leaflets it's printed, you know, Taliban is wicked, you know, join the Northern Alliance, etc. But they're doing this in a country where over 97% of the population is illiterate. And that is just downright brainless, in my view. And it shows you the degree of lack of knowledge in Washington. You know, I have never in my life seen so many so-called experts pontificating on a country that they know nothing about, that nobody's ever been to, might as well be on the moon, but everybody has the answers. And this leaflet thing, you know, winning the hearts and the minds of the Afghans, it was described, really sent chills up my mind, because I'm a U.S. Army Vietnam era war vet, and I've heard all this before.
Well, let's talk a little, if you can, then, about what it is like in Afghanistan today, and what it was like when you were there.
Well, today and when I was there, very little different. It's a medieval country. It's a beautiful country physically, but it's very poor. The rains have not come in 4 years. That's why there are 4 million people now starving. There are at least 10 million mines left over from the war against the Soviets, scattered all over the place. People can't go in the fields to work. There are over 5 million Afghan refugees in Pakistan and Iran. The country is dirt poor. They were always amongst the poorest people in the world. There are hardly any natural resources. There's very little commerce left. Still a tribal society. The largest group are the Pashtun, or we call Pathans here. They're the world's single largest tribal society, followed by the Kurds. And they are people who live in the earlier. They're just racing into the 11th century AD now. These are very they're very traditional tribal people. And, you know, when you hear all these heart-rending stories about Taliban oppressing women, that is not Islam. It's not so much a political policy as it is the way of the tribes, not only in Afghanistan, but in northern Pakistan, in Iran, and parts of rural India. This is tribalism. And they are people who live in clans, and they're ruled by local warlords or chiefs, and they're very fiercely independent.
Now, originally, regarding, you know, the oppression of women, the Taliban, as I understand it, were preventing women from being raped.
That's correct. The Taliban, we have to jump back to look at this. The people who are now the Northern Alliance were ruling in Kabul in 1994. They refused to share power with the other parties, some other Mujahideen groups. Civil war erupted. Afghanistan dissolved in chaos. Women were being widely raped and attacked across the country. And this was the single issue that motivated the Taliban, who were formed by Pakistani intelligence, mainly from war orphans. These men of the Taliban are people whose parents were killed by the Soviets during the war, in which 2 million Afghans died. And they were in religious schools. They had no other place to go. There were no other schools for them. They were formed into an army, and they swept into Afghanistan, and they ended the rape and the chaos and the banditry that was going on, and were widely accepted by the people. Yes, they behaved like backwards hillbillies in Kabul, where there was a tiny westernized intelligentsia that was left over from the Russian communist days. But as far as the rest of Afghanistan went, nothing really changed when the Taliban came into power.
And yet that has changed over these last 6-7 years?
The Taliban has imposed a dour and very backwards and narrow-minded medievalist policy. In other words, just tribalism extended not only in the countryside but also in Kabul. They have also ended the heroin trade. Afghanistan was the world's largest producer of opium poppies, and from which heroin was made. And according to the UN, the Taliban has stopped the heroin trade completely. I believe when Taliban is overthrown that the trade will resume. It's according to the New York Times, the Northern Alliance people, who are now America's allies, are the main dealers now in the Afghan opium trade.
And let's talk about the potential of overthrowing the Taliban. Do you see that happening, and what would be the result for Afghanistan?
Well, I think it will be relatively easy for the United States to, once, what the U.S. will do is they're going to seize the major airfields in the northern city of Mazar Sharif. From there, American forces will covertly back the Northern Alliance, and Russian forces, I might add, were already into Afghanistan, will also join this alliance, and they will march on Kabul. It's not very far. They will put in the Northern Alliance government, and the Taliban, or the Pashtuns, will then take to the hills, as they promised, in the mountains, and they'll fight back. So the question is, who's going to keep the new government in power? Well, it'll probably have to be American troops, and this is what I find also a dismaying prospect, because the longer, every day that America stays in Afghanistan, it will build lifetime enemies. America has no business there. It needs to get in, and if it can't find bin Laden, it needs to get out. The worst thing it could do is become a permanent colonizing power.
And let then the Afghanis once again perhaps engage in civil war?
Well, there will be civil war as a result of this, but eventually, if outside meddlers can be denied access to Afghanistan, the war will eventually peter out from lack of oxygen or die out, and the Afghans will go back to the modus vivendi they had before the Soviet invasion in 1979. But which is sort of like a feeble government in Kabul and just a generally local regionalism run by warlords in the rest of the country. Unfortunately, the United States is involved now. Iran is involved. Russia is deeply involved. India is involved. The French are involved. The people from Tajikistan and Uzbekistan are involved. So it's a witch's brew right now.
What has been the response? If you're reading publications and are aware, what has been the response from people around the world? We certainly hear of massive demonstrations in Pakistan, 10,000 people in New York City the first days after the initial strikes. But what has the response been that you are hearing?
There's been a predictable but not a huge response yet, because we haven't had reports of many casualties. And I would say 80% of Pakistanis, I would say 80% of people across the Muslim world, from Morocco to Indonesia, if not 95%, bitterly oppose this intervention. And while they sympathize, many Muslims sympathize with the anger and the fury of the United States over what happened in New York and Washington, they still oppose this attack on Afghanistan. I mean, really, most of the attackers, if we believe who they are, we still don't know, seem to have come from Saudi Arabia and from Egypt, and from Florida. So, maybe we're bombing the wrong country. But the United States has been straining every sinew to suppress the news coming out of Afghanistan. We saw this in Iraq. Now we're seeing even a more refined version in Afghanistan, and to cover up casualties. But as the casualties begin to mount, a word starts to seep out. Because remember, the Taliban did only one smart thing. They kicked out CNN, but they allowed Al Jazeera, the Gulf Arab TV network, to be there, and Al Jazeera is broadcasting honest news out of Afghanistan. And Americans don't like it. They want to suppress that. They want to suppress any bin Laden statements. But when news of casualties gets out and this becomes bloodier and nastier, I think you're going to see worldwide demonstrations against the U.S., and you're going to see Americans abroad put into danger.
And do you then foresee more attacks of the kind that occurred on 9/11?
I hope not, but I think it's certainly possible. I'm concerned about attacks on American property and citizens abroad. We had the case just last week of a Canadian who was murdered in Kuwait, shot in the back while he was walking that long because they thought he was an American. And how many American tourists now who go to Europe, for example, or Asia or other parts of the world, are now going to be subject to revenge attacks like this? It's a horrible prospect.
Just two other points. In terms of the Muslim world being united in getting the U.S. and Great Britain to stop this blitz of day and nighttime air attacks, do you foresee any united action on
No.
there?
No. The U.S. and Britain have exploited the Muslim world for the last 100 years, and to use bin Laden's word, plundered its resources simply because of the disunity of the Muslim world. And in the most horrible recent event, when 250,000 Muslims were slaughtered in Serbia, in Bosnia, by more Christian crusaders, as they described themselves, Serbian Christian crusaders, and where 25,000 Muslim women were raped, the Muslim world did absolutely nothing. The only Muslim country that took any action was Iran. And some Chechens and some Mujahideen, some of bin Laden's men, went to fight there. Aside from that, the Muslim world, with over 3 million soldiers, sat back and just watched. So I really don't think the Muslim world will do anything. Too many of its governments are run by the United States or in thrall to the United States, the most recent example being Pakistan, which had to stage an internal coup d'etat last week to align itself more closely with U.S. policy.
We'd not heard about that in the U.S. press.
Well, it wasn't described as a coup d'etat, or a palace coup, I think is probably a better word, but the nationalist Pakistani officers, the head of Pakistani intelligence, who I knew, General Mahmood, and other senior generals were ousted by General Musharraf, even though they were his friends and had brought him to power, because they were on Washington's blacklist. This move has made Musharraf popular in Washington, but it's made him very unpopular in Pakistan.
And then lastly, if I may, back to a point that you did mention, that perhaps Saudi Arabia might be a better target of our wrath. I think Robert Scheer in the LA Times actually suggested that as well. Why would Saudi Arabia, either facetiously or in actuality, be perhaps a more logical target?
Well, most of the most militant anti-American groups in the Muslim world come from Egypt and Saudi Arabia, and there's a very good reason for this. Both of their governments are U.S. protectorate. They've become U.S. protectorates. Their governments are kept in power by the United States. U.S. money, U.S. Security agents protect them. And both are repressive dictatorships. Well, one is a feudal monarchy, and Egypt is a military dictatorship. And it's amazing. The United States hectors and scolds China over its human rights record, but never says a word about its allies, or satrapies, as I call them, in the Middle East. Now, the people in Saudi Arabia and Egypt, both from all the way from religious fanatics, extreme Islamic religious fanatics, all the way to Democrats, have been trying to get rid of these repressive governments for 30 years, or 20 years, and the United States keeps them in power. So the United States has become the enemy of a lot of Saudis and Egyptians and other Arabs who are aspiring for representative government of one type or the other. This is no position that the United States should be in. It's shameful for the world's greatest democracy and champion of human rights to be keeping these small tyrannies in power. That's why so many angry people are coming at the United States from Egypt and Saudi Arabia.
And indeed, though, Saudi Arabia has also funded the Taliban.
Absolutely. The Saudi royal family has always had the policy of paying militants to be militant elsewhere. As long as they don't make trouble in Saudi Arabia, they pay them to stay away. And they've done this ever since the great jihad against the Soviets began in Afghanistan, and they continue to do this today. The most extremist groups in Afghanistan and bin Laden's people were all Wahhabis, the religious sect from Saudi Arabia. They were, and their money, by the way, does not come from bin Laden's so-called fortune of $300 million, which is baloney. It comes from regular day-to-day contributions from individuals and the royal family in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf.
So perhaps bin Laden then is not so unique.
He screams what most people in the Muslim world say out loud, and for that reason, this man who is to me a dangerous religious cultist has become undeservedly a hero. He's damaged the cause of the Palestinians. He's damaged the name of the Muslims around the world. But nevertheless, he is the avenger. He's the avenging voice of Muslim rage against the United States.
You've been listening to an interview with Eric Margolis, author of War at the Top of the World, The Struggle for Afghanistan, Kashmir, and Tibet. This is Martha Baskin.